On a tropical beach, an ocean away from what was once the strip mall of the damned. Past the palm trees and ramshackle hovel. Beyond the lifeboat wherein Brother Methuselah had reassembled the society podcasting equipment. A secret society assembles to scrutinize those films rumored to drive viewers to madness and dissolution. Draw closer, dear listener, and let your trembling ears sup upon the eldritch knowledge of the Cinemania Society.
We, the Fellows of Lensman, are armed to convene to judge eyes offering cinema in worthy of our esteem, or whether it should be cast down as worthless hokum.
Let's don our coconut shells in judgment.
Oh, bugger, I lost my coconut.
I still can't believe Clark Nova just bailed on me. Just because he had founded his own cult of insect stationary creatures? Did I mean nothing? I'll show them. I'll show them all.
I'm starving. I haven't eaten anything since those salty snacks I found on the beach yesterday.
You found salty snacks on the beach? Some people have all the luck.
Or maybe there are sea turtles on the beach. I saw a strange pit in the sand over there, roped off with sticks and twine. Eh? Turtle soup, anyone?
You can't eat sea turtles! They're an endangered species!
Fuck right, you can't. Those bastards will snap your hand clean up. You seen those beaks?
Or those gullets?
And why is my phone still not working? Is it still waterlogged from the shipwreck? Maybe if I bury it in this sand, it works with rice, right?
Zach, what are you doing running in and out of the waves?
There have to be crabs on this beach. Any shipwreck movie you can think of, Heart of the Sea, Mysterious Island, they always find crabs to eat. Where are you, you delicious little ocean monsters?
Even if you find them, we don't have any melted butter anyhow.
I just need a minute to catch my breath under this palm tree. Ouch! You crusty crabs! Where did you come from when I get my hands on you?
I think it scuttled away under that tree root. Not much meat on it, though. A sea turtle, on the other hand...
I said no!
If we don't eat soon, we're going to be endangered.
With our lack of sustenance, this society is rapidly losing its grip. Perhaps moving on to judgment will help us maintain our sanity.
I'll allow it. Inquisitor Ethan, you seem to have more wits about you than the other members. You can begin the judgment.
Me?
Yes.
Okay, that's funny, because I think I might be the hungriest, but oh well. Okay, so... I've seen this movie a few times. I really like it for a number of reasons. I really am more like talking about the movie and movies about this movie or inspired by this movie more so than this itself, although this is an excellent example of cinema and cinema history. So, like, I very much enjoy...
I feel like that's how you feel about all movies.
Well, in particular, this movie I like because there's a documentary about the making of the Island of Dr. Moreau from the 90s called Lost Soul, which is about Richard Stanley.
Oh, yeah, I think we've touched on that before. Yeah,
like, the making of that film was a complete shit show. It was also Marlon Brando's last film, if I'm not mistaken, and there's a lot of fun, weird stuff that came out of that. But anyway, so I just wanted, like, the thing about this movie in particular is it has a very iconic scene, one that has resounded down for, at this point, 90 years. And it's the one where Moreau steps up, bashes his gong, cracks his whip, and then demands, "What is the law?" And then all the beast people rear up and chant the law. And it's a chilling scene. Like, people have seen this. I think it was even done in, like, they parodied it in Muppet Babies or something.
Like, they did. Oh, my God, they did.
Yeah. Like, but, like, it's one of those things that just sticks in people's heads, and for good reason. You know, it's like it's been in popular fiction all throughout the 20th century. I mean, Devo and Oingo Boingo both did songs and ode to this scene.
Are we not men?
Not just songs, entire albums.
Yes. But as iconic as the scene is, it does not occur in the book. The law is there. The speaker of the law is there. But it's really, really different in the book. And I think it's for a couple of major reasons. So I'm going to dive into those. First, the book came out in 1896 and the movie came out in 1933. We just kind of think of that whole era as kind of one big smear, but the social, philosophical, scientific, and medical progress made in those 37 years cannot be overstated. So if you want to compare, RoboCop shot that one guy in the dick 37 years ago, right? For us.
He did.
Right. But we think about that film as still contemporary. Like, we at least in our generation, we're just like, oh, yeah, that just came out 37 years ago. This film, Island of Lost Souls, is quite sophisticated for its time, and it builds on the science fiction concepts that Wells introduces. So, like, the film has a line where Moreau boasts about making changes to a cell's germline, which is to say they're talking about genetic modification in 1933. Compare that to the book, which, again, as I said, was originally published in 1896. The changes Moreau was making to the beast people in the book weren't genetic. They were purely surgical. He was basically crafting flesh golems through plastic surgery, literally stitching together different species. In the book, the main antagonist among the beast folk isn't Uran. He's never named. He's simply referred to as the hyena swine. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's really interesting to see how they jumped forward on that in the movie compared to the book. I mean, they're both very interesting. Like Wells definitely is known for being prescient in some of the same ways that, say, Jules Verne was as well. Like, people cite Wells as being one of the people who made science fiction a viable genre. The guy was a futurist. Like, he was a practicing futurist. He's one of the people who helped craft the League of Nations for, you know, as toothless as it was, like, the idea of the League of Nations went on to found the UN, the idea of international law. He was one of the architects of it. But anyway, there's a reason why in the scene the animals all sit up and chant the law at the crack of a whip. There's a reason why they represented it this way. The screenwriters and people at the time were clearly studied. You have Pavlov's studies with classical conditioning, you know, where he conditions a dog to salivate at the sound of a bell. There were the early behavioral psychologists like Edward Thorndike and John Watson were studying how people and animals learn, what they call the conditioned reflex. And those theories that they built around the time this movie was made were later revised by B.F. Skinner in the 1950s into the operant conditioning model of behaviorism, which is and remains the foundation of all professional animal training today. Compare that to when Wells wrote the novel. Psychology barely existed as a discipline. I mean, we're talking about Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis, no integration with other schools of thought on learning and behaviorism, just, you know, the idea that behavior was linked to experiences. H.G. Wells had a very different take on the Speaker of the Law. He was more like a priest kind of character who squatted all day in this squalid hut chanting the law like biblical verses, and the beast folk were expected to go sit with him every day and recite the law with him. It was also described in the book much longer and duller and harder to remember, and the main protagonist, Prendick, I know his name's different in the movie, Parker, but, you know, at one point when he escapes Moreau, he ends up with this village with the beast people before he knows what's actually going on. He just kind of sits there with them in the hut and chants along the law, tunes out most of it. But it's not like this, you know, these simple, easy to remember things repeated at the crack of a whip. And I think that was actually a much smarter way that they did it in the movie. It doesn't have the same connotations, though. The whole function of the law in both book and movie are key features, but in different ways. So in the book, like, and again, the way the law is represented, you have to remember at the time, Marx, Bakunin, Nietzsche, these were all people who had risen into public prominence as philosophers and sociologists. Communism, anarchism, atheism, and nihilism were all very present things being chewed over in the public zeitgeist in the 1890s. And the book blends those currents with, you know, the thoughts about the dissolution of organized religion, because for the first time perhaps ever in history, rational people were beginning to recognize organized religion for what it is, a tool of social control. I think the book addresses that really well. The movie does not, but it addresses it, operant conditioning, in a totally different way. I mean, like, it glosses over the idea of law as religion, but it's looking more at conditioned reflex than it is looking at, you know, religion as tool of social control. Another thing that's really majorly different between the movie and the book is Moreau's death. In the book, he's killed in the jungle while chasing after the puma that breaks loose while he's working on it. The puma, which happens to be female, arrives on the island along with Prendick, and Moreau spends the first third of the book crafting her into a beastfolk woman. But the fact that it's female isn't really remarkable. There are other female beastfolk on the island. There's no forbidden love interest and these kind of weird side-eye hints at miscegenation, which the movie presents very clearly. You know, they don't directly say the word miscegenation, but there's a lot of heavy hinting at it.
Well, that is one of H.G. Wells's things going on in the book. Like, what's his name? Moreau is plotting to have them sleep.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's definitely not as big a thing. I think I would have picked up on it.
And Moreau was pretty much crafting the first furry.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, the novel presents Moreau's death as almost accidental, as opposed to like this is a thing caused by the revolution of the beast folk. It's represented as almost accidental and in very Nietzschean "God is dead" terms, because beast folk happen upon it sort of accidentally, and Prendick, the novel's protagonist, at that moment realizes his own life is now at risk now that the beast folk are doubting the religion of the law. And so he rather cynically seizes upon and applies the idea of transubstantiation in order to try to keep the beast folk in line. Now, Moreau's not dead. He's discarded his flesh that he's no longer needs and is watching us all from above. The law still applies. And, you know, some of the beast folk buy it, but most don't. And the last act of the novel concerns Prendick living alone among the beast folk during their descent into anarchism as they slowly revert to their animal natures. A lot of really heavy subtext here.
Without religion and God, society falls apart, right?
I don't think he's saying that exactly. I think he might be... Like, you can look at it both ways. I think he might be, you know, making critiques about human society specifically, or he might be saying that, you know, we need these structures to function. Like, you can make an argument either way. I'm going to get to that. But it's not surprising that the movie doesn't follow this arc, in part because, you know, limitations on time. People weren't consuming movies the way that we consume them now. And also because the special effects of the 1930s, they couldn't really show these animals reverting in the same way. But also because the Russian Revolution and the seizure of governments by fascists like Mussolini and Hitler, who were experts at wielding the power of the mob, were still like present. Those were things that had happened. They hadn't happened at the time that H.G. Wells was writing the novel. They were in theory. I mean, there were our anarchists and communists who were agitating to seize power, but they hadn't actually seized power. You know, whereas the filmmakers were watching this happen. Mussolini had done his march on Rome. They had seen the Russian Revolution and the, like, this was still fresh in people's minds. The first Red Scare had happened. So it's no surprise that they depicted Moreau's death as a result of the beast folk rising up in a mob. Also, compare that, you know, compared to the book, like, Prendick is not rescued by his girlfriend and they flee, you know, the descent from this island. No, he eventually escapes again sort of by accident when a boat full of corpses drifts to the island, and also one of which is redheaded, but Prendick implies but never reveals for certain that it's the drunken sort of semi-bestial captain who put him off the boat at the beginning. He disposes of the bodies, rows off to be miraculously rescued at sea by another ship, but yeah, not rescued by his fiance like in the movie. Two other major themes that appear in both the novel and the movie are colonialism and eugenics, and like, I've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks, and I cannot figure out whether these are presented in critical or apologetic terms. Sometimes I feel like it's one way, other times I feel like it's the other way. I do know that H.G. Wells believed in human improvement through science, and I think he supported eugenics early on, though he definitely later repudiated that position after World War II showed the true horror of using race science as national policy. Yeah. But I think he might have been being critical about colonialism is the whole idea of, quote, civilizing, quote, barbaric people was the core justification of colonialism and empire building, dating all the way back to the Roman Empire. And it's a justification that has been used by every one of Rome's successors, Great Britain and United States very much included.
Well, and one thing Moreau says is that man was supposed to be like the ultimate form. That's what all these animals were eventually going to evolve towards anyway. So he's just helping the natural progress. Like, he's not doing anything unnatural. This is where they were going to have gone anyways. very, very colonialist and eugenic.
Yeah, so like, I'm not sure if he's saying that we need these structures, because Prendick definitely seems like he's somebody who's in favor of it. He seems like a sort of a standard issue, you know, British soldier of empire kind of guy. But, you know, like, he's not represented in the heroic terms as he is in the movie, like very much in the book at all. And in neither book nor movie, Moreau is presented in positive terms at all, nor are his attempts to civilize people via religion and super science. And like I said, you know, Prendick or Parker is a pretty cynical bastard in the book, but he does come off better in the movie. One thing's for certain, though, the presentation of non-white people as animalistic is something that both the novel and the movie do to an unabashedly bigoted degree.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Reading the novel, it's pretty clear to me where H.P. Lovecraft drew inspiration for his notorious novella, The Horror at Red Hook. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot more I could say. I mean, a lot more, like a dissertation's worth. This is just scratching the surface. But, you know, so please, if anybody's listening, they're like, hey, you skipped over this or you glossed over this, please don't get upset. I just don't want to take up the entire conclave because other people have stuff to say, too. So for those reasons, for all the reasons detailed in the charges, but mostly for giving Mark Mothersbaugh fuel for one of the worst earworms of the 1970s, I judge this film guilty.
Hey, I liked that song.
Zach, go ahead.
Me? All right.
Yes.
Okay. 100 years ago, it blows my mind that we can watch films now from 100 years ago. It also blows my mind that this is not a phenomenon that's going to go away. As we are in the 2020s, we can go back to the 1920s and watch films of life 100 years ago. Now, this film's not quite 100 years ago, but it's close. It's what, 92 years ago?
Yeah, it's 92 years old.
I mean, that's crazy. What's also crazy is there are people still alive when this movie was released. Watching this movie, I had had a little trouble staying awake through it. I actually had to watch it 3 times because I fell asleep twice, which is funny to me because it's only an hour 10 and I'll like watch 3 of the Lord of the Rings director cut films back to back, you know, and not have an issue. I think that's partially because filmmaking as we know it was still developing. And one of the things that gave me a hard time is the lack of any Foley or background music in the film. So there's just these long swaths where there's literally no sound at all.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, back then they hadn't invented John Williams.
Yes. they were putting together a plan for John Williams, but he had not quite been perfected yet. But it's,
well, they had Foley and they had background audio. They just didn't have a soundtrack. They didn't have music to go along through everything like we have become accustomed.
Which is interesting to me because in before talkies, there was, you know, the organ player and instrumentals playing in the background of many silent films just to, you know, fill that void in the better theaters at least. So, and also, you know, due to radio, there was Foley for many radio plays. So it just all hadn't come together perfectly. And I was also thinking to myself, how much of that was just, you know, them not being able to mic people because, you know, they're like running through the background. And then when they get to a certain point, you would hear rustling and, like, you know, talking and footsteps. And it's like, is it only because they had their mics pointed at this one spot? It brought some interesting questions to me just about how films were made back then, 100 years ago, and what was still developing. The other thing that was really interesting to me is that the version of this movie that we have watched right now, the uncut version, was not released here in America for about 90 years. This film was considered so extreme that they had to cut out large sections of it for it to be released in Europe and the United States, actually. And that
version got an X rating. Isn't that crazy?
Uh-huh.
They didn't have a rating.
Well, yeah. And even that, the cut rating didn't get shown in UK until, what, 1958 or something?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, this movie was considered extreme. And, you know, and it's not for the reasons that you think. I thought initially it might have been because they thought Jaguar Girl or Panther Lady was too...
Susky.
Risque in her, you know, in her little bikini number that she had going on. But it wasn't that. It was the depiction of the House of Pain, talking about vivisection. These were all considered really scary, horrible things that they were afraid were just going to freak people out and give them nightmares. And the whole, like, and I do, I...
Just how much things have changed. That uncut version that was released in 2011 on DVD was rated PG.
Mm-hmm.
Just such a huge swing.
Well, I mean, it is... It's amazing how our sensibilities have like changed over time. But I will admit, the scene at the end where they all like they break into the medical instruments and they start grabbing the things that Moreau used to change him, when they throw him on the table and go around, and Moreau's screaming, and you just see the huddle of them like kind of stabbing and stuff. That I thought actually held up. That gave me a squick. That was like,
oh, it's horrific. Yeah,
yeah, like, it is horrific.
Like, you almost have a bit of, very good, like, less is more sort of scene. You know, like, less is more. They don't show us the explicit stuff. You just have to imagine it. It's pretty good.
Well, and that's the thing that you have to remember, right? Is like, we are used to a very different level of violence and gore and everything else on screen. But for the folks of the time, this really was horrific. And partly because it played on the, you know, less is more, you don't see it, it's hinted at, right? Like, that even we today got at least a little squicked by certain aspects of it.
Yeah, right?
Like,
I mean...
You just got to imagine what they were going through back then.
Sorry, it wasn't that long ago that they were freaking out people in theaters just by having someone fire a pistol directly at the camera.
That's right.
It was...
I had a question for Hope, though. When you said it received an X rating?
Yeah.
When did it receive an X rating?
I'd read that, too.
Yeah,
the cut version in 1958? The cut version that they...
Yeah, in UK gave it an X rating.
Okay, because the MPAA didn't really establish the rating system until, like... Well, okay, that would have been when there would have been really new rating systems. They didn't really
This was when they put it out
might be
in the
just
UK
like kind of
in 1958.
X-ish. I don't know if it's specific. I found that info on IMDb.
It was one of the first X-rated movies.
It said X certificate, so I'm not sure.
Okay, the British rating system is different from the U.S. Yeah. The MPAA has a different rating system.
I mean,
but
just for time frame sake, right? Just keep in mind. So when this movie first came out, and in 1932, and it was edited a lot to get it out in the US in 1932, the Hays Code had just landed. This was one of the early post-Hays Code films. So you can see its impact on the film.
Oh, yeah. And it's actually interesting if you even go pre-Hays Code in the 1920s and stuff, especially in and French cinema has always been wonderful about this, of just like how much, you know, sex and violence was actually in films before the Hays Code, you know.
Oh, that's some freaky, freaky shit right there.
Yeah, and it's just like, once again, we have this idea of society back then being very watered down, you know, and it's interesting when you see that, people back then were just as into all the weird, kinky, freaky shit that we are in now. Like if you watch M, one of Hitchcock's first movies, I mean, that is a freaky movie. And it wasn't that in the 1930s and 1940s people stopped being that way. It was just stopped being legal for them to have free artistic expression. So for the reasons that I have covered, but mainly because it gave the House of Pain the name for their band, and I have had jump around, stuck in my head for since the 1980s, I find this film guilty.
Okay.
So I have to agree with my colleagues here. I find the film very guilty for all of the reasons they've listed, but also, like Brother Ethan was saying, it's very ambiguous, their position on eugenics, on like social evolution, on what's the word I'm looking for?
Colonialism.
Like manifest destiny and the superiority of the white man and all of this. Like, are they criticizing it? Are they praising it? White supremacy, there we go. Are they criticizing? Are they praising? Are they pro or con? It's very ambiguous. And I think maybe they meant it to be that way. Like, you make up your mind, you think about it. Like, it definitely makes you think. And
without the context of actually having you know, fascists and stuff truly in government and not really having a minorities giving, like, having a voice at that time, it's interesting that, you know, anyone's even questioning it, but I still, you know, thinking of it as good or bad, you decide. I mean, now we're very much just like, no, that's bad.
Yeah, but at the time, you, like you said, minorities weren't speaking for themselves. They didn't have a voice. So are these people just, are they trying to, like, say, oh, look, you know, these minorities, these savage men really do our people? Or are they saying, look how terrible they are. We need to civilize them. It's really ambiguous, I think, in the film, if you take into account the time period. And also, I know they state later that Lota is not Polynesian. She's a creature. She's the Panther Woman. But the fact that he could even try to say she's pure Polynesian, I mean, that's the whitest damn Polynesian woman I've ever seen in my life. Like, I know it's black and white, but you can tell. You can tell she's pretty darn white.
Well, I have a friend who would be bitterly incensed at that. Like, she would be really, really pissed.
Well, and rightfully so. I mean, it's straight up yellow face. Like, I mean, it's black and white, but, like, you can see from the way they painted the eyebrows and, like, shaped the eyes that they're...
Yeah, they,
like,
gave her big old bushy eyebrows.
Far off from John Wayne and Genghis Khan. I mean...
And that wig they had her in was pretty damn awful.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go on.
They were doing yellow faces recently as the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Breakfast at Tiffany's, they had yellow face. I mean, so many like movies that we think of as classics.
Remo Williams, The Adventure
Remo
Begins.
Remo Williams,
I love Remo Williams.
He won an Oscar for that. His yellow face performance. Yes.
That's Joel Grey.
And like we were saying about the ratings changing and stuff, it just shows kind of the change, how our views of everything, how we perceive things just changes with time. It's a great example of just how the passage of time changes how we see things. I mean, I was trying to explain it to my mom, and I was like, you know, all those songs that were like hard rock and really, you know, progressive in the 80s, you know, they're on the soft rock adult channel, you know, radio stations now. You know.
Yeah, you all hear guys it in with the grocery big hair. Store. You
hear the Muzak cover of We're Not Gonna Take It.
Yeah.
It's not even that. I hear like RuPaul. I hear RuPaul in the grocery store now. It's like,
and in some ways, those can be great things because we're getting more progressive, you know, and they can be terrible things because we're like getting desensitized. So for, you know, shining a mirror back at us, I would deem it very, very guilty. Also for trying to pass that white woman off as Polynesian. God. So it's extremely guilty. So I've known a lot of Polynesians in my lifetime.
Looks nothing like that.
Mm-mm.
Andy, what about you?
Well, I came to this movie expecting to hate it. I thought, oh, this is going to be an old movie. It's really going to need us to overlook a lot of bullshit to even get through it. But I was amazed at how watchable it was. and how visually impressive it was. Because, okay, they didn't have special effects, but they did have these amazing sets with really impressionistic lighting that was clearly taking a lot of influence from Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, with these huge shadows that were coming from no obvious source but looked amazing. And I was also surprised by the performance of Charles Laughton as Moreau, because while everybody else in the film is doing this very stilted, theatrical, boy's own adventure kind of attitude, Laughton is almost doing a completely modern performance. He's got these funny little asides and looks that he gives. You can tell that he's scheming and thinking of things, and he's really thinking about the interior of the character. What is he thinking right now? What is he plotting and planning? And that, in a way, really brought me into the film in a way that, without him, I would have seen this as being far too stuffy and difficult to get into, to even watch. So I found that to be remarkable, for a start. There's also, as a lot of people have mentioned, the issue with the presentation of the other, the foreign in this film, and specifically the Panther Woman. And I was reminded of an actress called Theda Bara from the 1920s, pre-Hays Code, who was presented as being the vamp, the original femme fatale, the woman with the hungry eyes, they called her. And they made up lots of stories about her. They said she's come from exotic oriental lands. Nobody knows who she is. She's probably murdered someone for real. And
wasn't she from Nebraska?
Yeah, she was. She was actually some, you know, American chick who happened to get lucky in an audition one time, and they just made up all this crap about her in order to make her seem exotic.
And I'm sure her actual name was like Maggie or something.
Yeah, they're trying to do.
She probably had some interesting ancestry, and she was just ethnically ambiguous and could.
She didn't have interesting shit. What she had was a lot of eyeliner and good lighting, and that's as far as they went to make her look in any way not white. But it's they're clearly trying to do the same thing with the Panther Woman, because they ran a nationwide campaign to find their Panther Woman. They had people compete to be in this film, and they basically picked a girl who used to be a cheerleader or something. Oh, a model, that was it, a model. And they're like, right, you are going to be our Panther Lady, and we won't even give you credit. We'll just credit you as the Panther Lady to build this sense of mystique. And I feel that when we're talking about all the reasons why this film was censored and kept out of the public eye for so long, the sex aspect has got to be part of it. Because, yes, it's violent. Yes, it's difficult in places with all the horrible screaming and whatnot. But there's a real throbbing sexuality to this movie. You've got the Panther Lady, obviously. And certainly to people of the time, there's lots of indicators that she is a femme fatale, you know, as they understood it at the time. A sex pot, a temptress, a destroyer of men.
I hate to agree with Andy, but...
Why?
Well, yes.
There's also very heavy implication that Moreau is gay. Like, very much...
As I was coming to this, this is part of Charles Laughton's performance and the way he's giving you the interior of the character, because he's living alone with his male best friend. He's created a woman, but he doesn't personally have any sexual attraction to her, but he sees her as being sexual and wants to explore that, but he needs another man to do that because he isn't going to himself. There's definitely an implication there.
You also can't ignore the throbbing sexuality unspoken between the sea captain and Parker.
Right.
But I feel like people at the time would definitely have read that as being, there's something between the lines here. There's a subtext that we find uncomfortable. And that has to have been in the minds of the censors, that there's, even if it's not said, there's something going on here that's sexually uncomfortable that made the censors of the time think, this is too much. We can't have this going out there. It's gone too far.
And like we said earlier, what's unsaid or unshown is even more powerful sometimes.
Yeah.
And I have to say, as I said, Charles Laughton makes this film for me. He's incredibly watchable. He was a theatrical actor before coming to Hollywood, and they gave him this, and he just ate it up completely, hamming it up, enjoying himself immensely, making a wonderful meal of this whole role. He makes me believe that he could be a dangerous super scientist conducting bizarre experiments somewhere in the South Seas. And for that alone, I judge this film guilty.
Well said.
Andy. I agree that Lawton, cold-blooded, that's all I can say, man. Yeah. Like, yeah. There's so many scenes, everyone else is, like, freaking out. He's like, yeah, it's just going according to the way I planned it. Like,
almost.
Who is this man?
Almost like Hannibal Lecter if he had a sense of humor.
And a goatee.
And a goatee. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and like...
I know, he just plays it so cool the whole time. Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, they're quite dangerous. Here, have a gun. Have
it's a gun. Right here. Yeah, here, have a gun. I don't care. Like, it's funny, though, Andy, I read his performance a little differently. If anything, he seemed the most classical, like almost... the silent era, right? Like, so like what you were saying about the asides and the way he'd like look at the camera and then look off to the side, like that seemed very much something from the silent era, right? Where you're kind of, the camera is the audience and you're having a conversation with them with your eyes and your face through
He's
that.
Definitely aware of the audience in a way that the other actors probably aren't.
Oh, yeah. No,
straight
no.
up saying
you
their
know,
lines.
He's definitely much stiffer. The only person I thought who was doing it, like, who got some truly modern moments was Bela Lugosi.
Oh,
oh
yeah.
My God. Are you and, like, serious? This,
yeah. Hear me out on this. So, like, because, and he also, and it's like, yeah, Lawton was amazing. He rocked this movie. Except when Bela Lugosi shows up, every moment that Bela Lugosi is on screen is just like, and now this movie's mine for 60 seconds. And it's almost like the cinematographer knew it. He gets the only modern camera angles, too.
He gets right? only the modern like, you know, close-up. Like, actually, he gets a modern close-up.
Well, he gets a modern close-up. He gets a couple of old-school close-ups, but like the way the camera comes down very dynamically at him for those like angles when he's got his arm out, like, the law of man! You know, like, really modern stuff.
I kind of feel like maybe they were working around the makeup with him that wasn't great, and that was the only way to make it seem good was to judge the angles carefully.
Lugosi was the last one cast on this film, and he only took the role because he was going through bankruptcy. They paid him less than everybody else because he had very few lines. He was going through bankruptcy, and that's how they got him. Otherwise, I think before, had they done it earlier, he would have been too big for this, you know? But then he
that
was in a place where they could cast him for such a small role.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense then. So
trivia.
Probably... Yeah, I didn't know that. So that explains why his role is so small, but also why his is almost like it's shot differently. So they probably shot him last.
Okay. Maybe.
I don't know that, but I'm sure like they didn't want to cast him and like overshadow everybody else either, you know?
Yeah.
How does that play into your judgment, if at all?
We'll find out come the interlude. Or no, after the interlude.
Wait, where's Daniel? He was here just a minute ago.
I'm not sure about Brother Daniel, but there is something urgent I need to show you.
Well, I certainly don't need to see any shows from you. Blech.
But it is really quite important. Yesterday, when I went up the beach past the third palm tree to the left to gather some driftwood for your shelter, I found...
This is really boring. Can you please stop talking?
I know a way to shut you up, you scrotal nightmare. Cannibalism has gotten a bad rap, I say. Perhaps we should give it a try. Then we can finally be rid of Brother Methuselah in a stew.
No.
Absolutely not. We need someone to carry the broadcasting equipment. But besides, he'd be far too tough and stringy.
And gamey. And just smell it.
It's a pungent mix of mothballs and ointment.
Wait. Is that Profligator Daniel coming out of the jungle with a spear?
Are we back on?
No!
Just asking.
Profligator Daniel, what are you doing with that very pointy stick?
I refuse to let Clark Nova abandon me. If he won't return willingly, I'll bring him back on a spear, sharpened at both ends.
No one is spearing anything until we finish this judgment. Now, give me that.
Sorry. Not sorry.
Alessa, you can continue our judgment. Any objections?
No. No, we better listen to the lady.
Yippee!
Don't argue with a woman with a pointy stick.
No objections, per se. I mean, like, this very much. I couldn't put my finger on it, but this movie really seemed to run similar to a lot of, like, plot lines of later movies, of going to an island and having all of this shit happen, and then you fuck off once everything explodes. Yeah, I feel like this is like, what's it, an origin film, of course, not without its own problematic elements, but...
Like a precursor to all of those other films.
Yeah, it was very much, yeah, it's had a lot of elements that I think really built out all of these various other films. Everyone keeps trying to figure out if it's like... You know, is it anti-imperialist? Is it pro-imperialism? Is it satire? I'm going to come out and say that it is as problematic and as 1930s as it is. I'm going to say it is anti-imperialism. And the moment that really sold it for me was when the main guy, what was it? Peters?
Oh.
Parker.
Yeah.
Parker. Wait,
you mean
anyway,
Parker. Yeah, Pepperdine, let me take that back. Pendrick, whatever. Yeah.
The moment
Prendick
that sold
in the book,
it for...
Parker in the movie.
Okay. But yeah, the moment that sold it for me was Parker taking Dr. Moreau's tea and like beating him over the head with it. That's what sold it to me, that this was definitely more skewing anti-imperialist rather than like more ambiguously so. And yes, this is 1930s, and yes, there's a lot of really horrific tropes in here, but I think that's definitely like the moment where it's like, okay, fuck this guy. I'm sure everyone already talked about, yeah, we probably ad nauseum talked about white saviorism a little bit. It was, yeah, very, very classic 1930s island excursion.
I mean, what else do you do on an island other than get into trouble so that nobody can see you?
Yeah,
other than excurge.
Excurge.
But yeah, and then you leave the island while everything is exploding, because... That's just how it goes. It's you know.
Because you're the white savior. You're done saving them. So there's nothing left to do except just like, blow up the island and walk away.
Are you saying flee the scene while everything explodes behind you? We don't know what you're talking about there. That never happens to us. Shut up.
Plus, you're so cool, you don't even turn around to look at the explosion.
That reminds me of a Forbidden Planet, actually. Except it was the whole planet that time.
Forbidden Planet. Yeah.
Forbidden Planet reeks more of white saviorism than this movie does. This is more like, you know, reaping the rewards you have sown, and then Parker was more like standing by and watching what happened as, you know, and then was like bailing when everything was melting down around the mad doctor's head.
Absolutely.
I think, Alessa, you're onto something, that this movie is trying to make a point about colonialism, amongst other things. It does undermine itself somewhat with just classic 1930s white savior storytelling. You know, it can't help itself. I mean, he bashed Moreau over the head with a tea set because, well, it's fine that you did this to all these other creatures, but to a woman, you know. But
okay,
no,
yeah,
please continue.
Point.
I think, Lessa, you're really onto something. Please continue.
This is like the very beginnings of where I guess the proverbial cracks were starting to show. And then it's just like, I don't know. I'm trying to find the words, but it's very much like, yeah, you're trying. You're trying. You're getting there. The point is probably, you know, a few leagues off, but, you know, you're working toward it. And that's what we're here for. What? 90 years later? 90 years later. You're like, good job, guys. You tried. It was an attempt. I also love that Parker was very much like... This can play into the white savior narrative, but it more played into the what What we sometimes say in the queer community as what the bimbofication of the male main character, where he's just kind of cluelessly going through this whole ordeal and just kind of thrust into the, oh my God, this is so fucked up. How did I end up here? I was just in a shipwreck, man. I don't know what the fuck is going on. And I, out of all like main characters in these kind of narratives, I think Parker is actually one of my favorites because he's genuinely like pretty kind, genuinely pretty fucking clueless, which gives him a pass on quite a few things.
So you're saying he's just kind of a himbo?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's also a good point too, is because I can't think of any movie that I've seen pre 1960 something where the male main character is rescued by his female love interest. Like that happens in this movie. I mean, so that, and as you said, the sort of the anti-colonialist mindset on this really explains a lot as to why this movie got banned in so many places in the Western world for, big sections well, were cut they, out of it until like the 2010s.
They did start with Ruth trying to rescue him, but then they walked it back and he had to rescue Ruth from the creature. Uran?
Well, they can only go so far with this, Hope. I mean,
right. She still had to be.
When could a woman ever effectively rescue someone? But the attempt is, innovative.
Is admirable. And like Alessa was saying, baby steps, right? Baby steps. They had an attempt.
Baby steps.
He's definitely a very passive hero because he just gets plucked out of the sea and just from that point on kind of just goes along with whatever's happening to him and just moves from one event to the next. And it's just like, oh, this is happening now. Oh, I'm on an island now. Oh, there are these creatures here now. And just moves from thing to thing to thing.
Yeah, it's reacting.
It's like creatures.
Yeah, it's like a tabletop one-shot. Shit just happens.
Back to the himbo thing, it would explain why when his fiance finally shows up, he doesn't just say, let's get the hell out of here. He's like, I gotta pack. Like, dude, what?
He has to pack.
I know, right?
Come on, give that him was a fucking stunning. Break.
Leave your white linen suit stunning. And get the fuck out of Dodge.
It wasn't his, it was a loner from Montgomery.
Well, then he needs to preserve it even more. Come on.
Does he there's really care about Montgomery? Is it like a love gift?
There's a lot of kind of low key gay references in this movie, or in the case of Moreau, high key gay references.
I was about to say low key. Say.
Yeah, I kind of got that as well, very much so. Especially with the whole like classic. I'm not going to use the word classic because that's annoying. The antiquated tropes with women in this era of cinema. And he was just very much like, science and all that.
Well, and he had to bring someone else in to test Lotta, rather than he couldn't just sleep with her. He or Montgomery, neither of them could try to seduce her.
Well, that's because technically, she was afraid of them. I mean, they did torture her for hours.
That is also very fair.
Okay, valid point. But, I mean, they went over a lot of stuff. They pushed a lot of, they crossed a lot of other lines. You'd think they would cross that one, too.
I think the subtext was pretty strong, at least. I mean, but
Yeah, it was also his just general attitude. While, I don't know, some of the tropes maybe went over my head, but the vibe definitely was there. I mean, Jesus Christ, look at that fake goatee. Like, come on.
Please, Alessa, are you saying because of your love for Parker, do you feel like this film is not guilty of cinemania?
Well, as much as I like to talk about Parker, and as much as I'd like to talk about all of that stuff, it is unbelievably and irredeemably guilty.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Suspicion is enough to convict.
Oh my God.
Hey, listen. That sounds like the noise dinner makes.
Ooh, I like the way you think.
Oh, let me at him.
Daniel, take the spear.
Yeah, Billy,
kill.
I moved on to another port. What the fuck? How are you morons still alive?
The paddle boat sank. I had the only functioning life vest.
Wait, Captain Cajun guy? From the paddle steamer? You left us to die on a sinking ship? Why?
And where's your amazing Cajun accent? It was like warm butter and quaaludes on waffles.
You assholes burned down my restaurant! You didn't even leave a fucking tip!
Oh no, we are so screwed.
Who is it? A cinema assassin?
It's the waiter from the pirate bar.
Oh.
And also our recent boat captain. I totally knew that accent wasn't real.
You might just be right about that there, little lady. That restaurant was my retirement from a life at sea.
Surely you still aren't mad about the R you can eat shrimp. It said it was bottomless. Who am I to read the fine print?
Call me Shirley again and I'll keelhaul you, boyo.
Oh, shit.
Because of you idiots, I had to flee my burning, sinking restaurant when the cops arrived.
I knew there was a reason we left before the aperitifs.
So I liberated a paddle steamer, chugged over to the Big Easy, and waited for my revenge. Because it was only a matter of time before you idiots ended up in Nolans.
Diabolical much?
Exposition much?
Liberated a paddle steamer?
It's the only other job I was qualified for.
That's certainly a limited skill set.
Pirate! Don't you take that tone with me! I'll buckle your swash so fast it'll make your head spin!
Okay, jeez.
But then that storm ruined my plans to maroon you on a sandbar, and I ended up shipwrecked with you all in Puerto Rico, when everyone knows the best rum is Jamaican.
I thought it was Dominican.
We're in Puerto Rico?
Qué buena.
I thought I'd be safely away from here. I thought you'd all be doomed. But here I am again, a waiter at another lousy waterfront dive, serving drinks.
Oh, yeah? Well, speaking of which, could I get a dark and stormy Daniels?
You can get a fuck off!
Ooh, what's in that?
Look, we're not responsible for your career choices.
I'm not gonna let you get away with it, screwing everything up again. This time, me hearties, you won't be able to cut and run.
Why does everyone want to stab us all the time? It's so Freudian.
Avast, ye scurvy lovers! What the hell is that?
Hey, Danny boy, is this guy hassling you?
Get him, Clark Nova.
Yeah, me too. Come here, you. I want to crawl all over your face and whisper sweet nothings in your ear. The needle's resting.
Get him! Get him! Oh, Clark Nova, who's your good abomination? Yes, you are. I am so glad you're back. Don't you ever run off on me like that again.
Well, that makes two unexpected appearances today.
Not exactly unexpected. We ran into it earlier in the jungle. Don't ask.
Weren't you planning to stay in the jungle?
Am I missing something?
Oh yeah, Clark Nova was king of his own jungle cult of grotesque insect stationary supply creatures.
Yeah, you have to tell me how you organized that so quickly.
Oh, ever read Dianetics?
Okay, weird. But if that's true, why did he come back?
You know you bug proud in the jungle. By the way, I think I may have earned a bump for that last little service, anyone.
Clark, you want a bump? You want a bump?
Yeah, I want a bump, Clark. You want bumping? Tickle me, tickle me, tickle me.
Speaking of the jungle, I've been trying to tell you there is a resort right up the beach.
A resort? A beach resort. With liquor?
And food?
And Wi-Fi.
Yes, yes, and yes. But they won't give you the password until you've brought at least two drinks. I've been trying to tell you, but you didn't listen.
Drat it! Just when I had finally consolidated my power over the society.
We should definitely check out this source of potential cult members. I mean hotel.
To the hotel!
To the fully stocked bar!
And the R you can eat buffet!
To the end of the episode!
Yay! Yay!
Ha 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 ha. That episode of the Cinemania Society was written and performed by Andrea Palladino, Andy Slack, Daniel Scribner, Zachariah Burks, Ethan Ireland, Alessa Luz Martinez, and Hope Bravo, with special guest Miles Miniacci. Produced, mixed, and mastered by Ethan Ireland. Music by Carl Casey at White Bat Audio. Sound effects and incidental music courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Iris was excerpted from Naked Lunch by William S. Burroughs. Copyright 1959. Visit our social media feeds on Facebook, Twitter, X, at TCS_Cinemania.
And Reddit at r/TheCinemaniaSociety. Happy now.
If you really like what you've heard, visit us on Patreon and chuck us a couple bones, because making podcasts ain't free.
Very special thanks to Alexandros Katadakis and Ziv Lang for making this episode possible. The Cinemania Society is a product of the Cinemania Society, LLC.